The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks for joining me today on January 25th, 2014. My topic today is the best arguments to use when discussing the truth or falsehood of the common beliefs people have about the Auschwitz-Birkenau death camp. Whether it was indeed the place where more Jews were murdered than any other place on the face of the earth, or whether it was, and therefore also during what is known during the Holocaust, if this indeed took place. Also, I want to talk to you about, I'm just getting my sound level up here, so I'm going to move my mic back a little bit. And turn it down, so it's going to cause some disruption. All right. I want to talk also today about the importance of accuracy in our communications. People just repeating things as they remember them, and I'm guilty of that myself, and not going to the actual source and quoting it precisely. This creates a lot of misunderstanding and problems among various personalities. But first, I want to thank some contributors. This week, I want to thank Paul from California. He's a regular contributor. There's a lot of Pauls out there. This is Paul from California. I'm not sure if I should use people's last names, so I don't. But he's always generous, and he sent his best wishes for a great new year. And this was a couple weeks back. And thanks also to Jaime Schwartz again from Brooklyn, New York and Tel Aviv. I'm finally getting a little bit better idea about this Jaime. And he wrote me a note this time and said, love the show. Have a great new year. So I knew right all from the beginning that he wasn't really named Jaime. He says that, and this time at this note, he gave me his first name, which wasn't Jaime. So anyway, I'm not going to tell you what it is, though, but it's nice to hear from him. And he's been very, very helpful, I must say. And he likes to joke. Then also a new contributor, Conrad from Australia. Got a nice message from him and very, very pleased to have him. Like to show enough to the shows to contribute to them, to our upkeep. So, continuing on then, what I said I wanted to bring up, that this is a very common failing that we hear of claiming things from memory, that someone has said this or that as a source, and it's the source of a lot of animosity that we can get into. We can be often incorrect in our memory. Boy, I really know that now. I used to have such a good memory that I depended on it longer than I should have. It would come as a shock to me that something that I was sure I remembered just the way it was, when it was brought up to me, or sometimes I might went back and look, I was just totally shocked that I was wrong, because I didn't used to be wrong ever. But, you know, these things change. So going back to the source, as you know, we can be very surprised that what we think we heard or what we remember is not actually there. And so this, you know, it occurred to me that this is what scholarship means. Scholarship and doing scholarly work is not it has a kind of a connotation, at least it always has for me, that it means it's very deep, kind of high level academic work, and it, you know, it means that you, you know, it's not, most people aren't going to be able to follow it, and it's just, you know, difficult. But that's not, I think what scholarship actually means is that you exactly source everything that you take from others that you use to build your argument. It can be a simple argument. It can be a very complex and, philosophical argument. But you have to back up everything that you say that you take from other people. If it's your own opinion, you indicate that. But if you're saying this is, you know, if a lot of other work and which is done by other people is involved in your writing, your argument, your paper, and so on, you have to be very exact about that, and you have to show exactly what was said or what was written and where, and so that other people can go and see it for themselves. And taking the time to do this and having the means with which to do it, such as having all those books like it used to be, having all these books that you can look into and that you can give the exact page number and so on where things are found, is what separates scholarship from opinion writing. And this is what needs to be appreciated maybe a little bit more. You know, now with the internet, we have, we link to pages on the internet where it is what we're talking about is found. And this is becoming more and more common that people don't have to own all these books or get all these books. Or if you can find it on the internet in a source in a source that's credible, and you can just link people to that. But this is what's done so much in the internet age. But in any event, you have to show, and all I'm saying is that at the bottom line is that people who paraphrase what was said, what they heard, for example, on radio programs like this one, and then repeat what they think they heard, never bothering to present an exact quote of it. And this is this shouldn't be tolerated, really, and by me either. I mean, if I do it, it shouldn't be tolerated. This is we have to take the time to find out, and we should, if we're going to say so-and-so said this, we really need to present exactly what they said and tell people where they can find it also. So for example, now I'm going to bring up someone I really don't want to bring up. I don't want to get into any kind of anything with Veronica Clark. But this one thing that she keeps repeating, it bothers me that I don't answer it, that I feel I should answer it. Because if you don't answer things, it's like you don't disagree with it or something. And she keeps repeating that I said that I thought that I know that I said that she wrote. Yeah, that no, that I thought she wrote Adolf Hitler's Platterhof speech herself. I never said this. You see, I never said it. And what I did say, I had to go back to that radio program where I talked about the Platterhof speech and find what I had actually said. I remembered that I knew I didn't say it, but I thought, well, I have to get it exactly myself. I can't just say I didn't say it. So I went back, I went to that, and that's where she's getting this from. And what I did say was, I said, this is me now, and I'm not saying this is the most intelligent thing I ever said in my life, and it's not very well presented, but this is what I was kind of talking to myself in part of this, because this I thought just popped into my mind. But these are the words. I want to say, it's not hard to think this is not Hitler's real speech. People just assume that it is. They don't even ask the questions. I imagine there are people who do question it, but the general run don't seem to. It could be a big lie, even. Well, no, I don't think she could have written it. She couldn't write anything like this. Those were my words. So I didn't say I think she might have written it or even suggested it. It did pop in my head there as I was talking. And then as I said, it could be a big lie even. But then I answered that. And I was halfway, this was halfway just going on in my own, you know, my own thinking, which I was expressing out loud. But then I immediately said, no, I don't think she could have written it. She couldn't write anything like this. And I left it at that. So I don't, you know, for her to say, to take this and then say, well, Carolyn Yeager thinks that, you know, said that she thinks I wrote it myself. Ha, ha, ha. Boy, you know, where does she get that and stuff like that? See, it's just this kind of business. If she or anybody, I'm going to get off of her now. If anybody wants to say what someone said, they need to go to the source of it and quote the exact words. Or same with writing. You know, if you say it on a program where talk is a lot more loose than if I were writing, I wouldn't have put these words together quite like this. But you know, you have to do this. So this is something I would be urging, and I'm going to try to do it myself. It takes time, and we all don't have time, and we don't want to take the time. Or there's either that, or the other possibility is that you want to misrepresent it, and you hope that people will accept your misrepresentation and won't look it up for yourself. Now, another aspect of this whole problem, and I don't know if it might be a totally different subject than another aspect of this, but it's our growing expectation on the internet to get things easily, quickly, you know, don't spend too much time in any one place, you know, look, go here, find out something, look at the headlines, look at the main ideas, don't read everything that you're even reading or, you know, looking to find out about, and then move on and think that you have enough information that way. And this comes from, you know, I was thinking about what to call this, and I came up with the term sound bites, which has been around for quite a while, but dealing with television, news, and it's really a good word to use for that, because we've become more and more accustomed to getting our information as sound bites. And think about Twitter and just writing tweets, and, you know, it leaves no room for any complexity of thought. You just make one sentence for the most part. I think I'm not on Twitter. I won't use those things. But I think there's a limit to how many characters you can use, so you have to keep it short. So people are communicating in this, you know, extreme shorthand of ideas. And I think that we are more and more reduced to simplistic thinking because of this. So, there has always been a preference in the general run of people, in all of us, for sensationalism, for something new, something a little bit shocking, you know, and gossip and drama. We're always attracted to that, and that hasn't changed any. So getting people to pay attention to serious work is not the easiest thing. Maybe it's surprising that as many people do who do, you know. Maybe that's the surprise, that so many people get past this and will spend the time to really look into things. And I'm going into this because I want to talk about this new website that I've been talking about so much, which is January27.org. I think that I know that it's not the most exciting site, and it's not it's easy to figure out, but it's doesn't have a lot of little short stuff on it. It has a few things like that, but so I thought that to get more people to go there, to get people to go there and stay there and read things, takes a bit of doing, and I'm not much for making things into, you know, sound bites and turning things into good sensational looking images and so on, as some people are. But I think that if you're going to have an argument, I mean, talking about, well, okay, this January 27 and a commemoration is coming up. It will be the actual day on Monday. But, and there's not very much in the media about it. And I have a feeling there's not going to be very much this year. Although on Monday they'll have the usual stories, and I found a few things. The hope is that at this time, as people are looking at this, that the media is putting out in their usual narrative about Auschwitz, that this is an opportunity to get people's attention and get people either to, maybe by mistake or on purpose, to take a look at this particular website, which is devoted to just the Auschwitz mythology and why it's not. What are the arguments against it, and have a little bit of an open mind if you can find people with an open mind. So I do encourage those with websites and blogs, and maybe I haven't seen anything yet, but maybe some people are waiting until Monday, although that's a little bit late, but maybe that really is the only time it would mean anything. So that's okay, but in any case, to focus on this a little bit and to link to and recommend this site, www.jan27.org, for people to go to and maybe comment on some of the particular pages that are there. And so that's what I'm dealing with today, and in preparation for going into these arguments, some of these arguments that I think are the best arguments if you're talking to someone about it, I want to do a few preliminary items here. And one is that I got this email from the CarolynJaeger.net contact page. You know, that was, you could go to that contact, and there you can write what you want to write to me right there. And I get quite a few of those. And usually that, you know, I don't pay attention to one like this, but I did this time. I mean, I read it. And then when I was preparing this program, I thought it would be a good idea to include this, because it's so typical of what the believers believe and what stands out most important in their minds. Now, I don't know who this person signed himself as Derek. I don't know who he is, but he said, "Dear Carolyn," starts out real nice, "read your site. Congrats, you are truly a nut job. Go look at the pictures of the dead and read the testimonies of those who participated and survived the Holocaust." Oh, yeah. Well, there's a lot of pictures of dead, but, you know, reading the testimonies, I've read plenty of them. It's like recommending that you read Irene Zizblatt's The Fifth Diamond, you know, and so you can learn about what she went through. Anyway, he goes on, "This was one of the most horrific events in human history." You see that? The most horrific events in human history. And to try and revise the history of what really happened makes you almost as terrible as the Nazis. Well, then with a little research, not only will you find factual evidence of the atrocities committed by the Nazis, but you will also find countless testimonies. Okay. Some, he says, even given by former SS members that indeed testified to the ghastly torture and murder of some 17 million people, including Jews, Poles, Slavs, Romani, POWs, and many others. A testimony given by former SS Rotenfuhrer Oskar Gröning is one example. Now, this Gröning has come up recently, and I haven't really looked into it, but other people have mentioned his name just recently, so obviously he's been in the news in some way. He's been brought up. Again, maybe. And this is a quote from Gröning. He says, "I would like you to believe me. I saw the gas chambers. I saw the crematoria. I saw the open fires. I was on the ramp when the selections took place. I would like you to believe that these atrocities happened because I was there." Now, you know, you'd think there are people who, I don't know if this would make anybody believe anything, but there are people who would, you know, not even blink at this, would just take it as okay, you know, or, all right, there's another one. There's another SS man who's confessing what took place without even paying attention to the fact that he doesn't say anything except, "I saw this and you should believe me." My letter writer goes on. "I understand that the Allies," this is a person who knows exactly what the arguments are. See, he's not a novice. He says, "I understand that the Allies, along with former Holocaust inmates, committed their own violent acts on Nazi prisoners after liberating some of the concentration camps." All right, so the Allies and former inmates of the camps committed violent acts on Nazi prisoners that they had then taken prisoner, you know, people they call Nazis who they had taken prisoners after the end of the war. "But that is a drop in the bucket," he says, "compared to the human atrocities committed by the Nazis. Their acts were but crimes of temporary insanity and revenge." That is the acts of these Allies and so on. But the Allies were committing crimes all the way through the war. So that wasn't temporary insanity and revenge. But the former Holocaust inmates, or the former camp inmates, were, he's calling, temporary insanity and revenge, brought upon by, maybe also the British. Yeah, the British troops, the American troops and so on, that would come under the Allies. "Brought upon by seeing the horrific scenes of human injustice while liberating the camps." He's referring to what they did at Dachau, the American soldiers did, killing all those guards that were trying to hand over the camp, hundreds of them. And what they did at Bergen-Belsen, the British did that, you know, killing and executing these German personnel that were trying to turn things over to them. Then he goes on to say, "What the Nazis did was deliberately attempt to exterminate an entire race." Mm-hmm. "That's insanity on a whole different level. That's inexcusable. And to try and revise the history books concerning this matter is also inexcusable. If you want to continue to keep your head in the sand and be blind to the facts of what the Nazis did concerning the Holocaust, then that's up to you. You'll just continue to come across as a sad, ignorant individual. Regards, Derek." Okay, well, there's that. Then in looking at other things that are said, this in the media, I came across some photographs that CBS had up under Auschwitz Liberation Anniversary for this year. And one of the things that they said to one of the pictures was, Visitors walk in the former Nazi death camp at Auschwitz, January 17, 2005. In Auschwitz, southern—they spell it as the Polish spelling for the town or for the camp, southern Poland. An estimated 600,000 people visit the camp each year to learn or to grieve quietly and in a spirit of reverence. That's kind of new, I think, in the spirit of reverence. That's being taken over more and more because they want to limit how much people can see in that. In that memorial museum, which is still called a camp, and what they can do on their own without guides telling them, and where they can go, and so on. So now it's all restricted because you have to show reverence there. Now you can't just wander around and look at things. Boy, thank goodness they didn't used to watch people. So when the revisionists were going down into those collapsed crematoriums and so on to learn things, I guess you wouldn't be able to do that today. It's a good thing it was done then. But I thought it was interesting that they used 600,000. Now they admit it's an estimate. An estimated 600,000 visit the camp each year. Well, it's always the six with the zeros after it, you know, always. And they just have to do that. And you'd think it would be such a giveaway. And it is, but they don't care. They want to just instill that number in everybody's mind when it comes to, I guess, when it comes to anything about Holocaust. Six, 000000. So then the other thing I found was something I wrote a little post on at my website yesterday, that the B'nai B'rith, which is the international Jewish organization, pro-Jewish organization, which is actually also a Freemasonic lodge, and they're huge international presence, and they have a chapters, you know, in every country and so on. It says that, but they, on their main website, they commended the Knesset, the Israeli Knesset, for holding legislative session at Auschwitz. And I thought that was so interesting. And I wrote a little bit about it, but I mostly just put down what they had written here. And they issued this statement. That's what they said there, that B'nai B'rith International commends the Knesset for planning to hold a special legislative session at Auschwitz-Birkenau in Poland, the largest Nazi death camp, on January 27th, the 69th anniversary of the camp's liberation. 64 members of Knesset, that's quite a few of them, along with numerous Israeli ministers, Holocaust survivors, and politicians from around the world will take part in the Polish government's annual ceremonies on the site of the camp. Well, this tells us that, you know, it's mostly Israelis and the Holocaust survivors that they even take with them, and others that come from around the United States. I mean, come from around Europe and elsewhere. Members of the Israeli parliament are going to be bringing a bunch of Holocaust survivors from Israel with them. And then the other people they have are politicians that they can round up and badger to come there and show up there. And then the Polish government sponsors it. So, you know, it's very much, we find, if you looking at it, it's very much a Jewish thing. It remains very much a Jewish thing, even though they can get some non-Jewish politicians to show up. And some of those politicians are Jewish, too. And they go on to say the historic visit, which they say occurs on International Holocaust Remembrance Day. Well, there's two Holocaust Remembrance Days then. They want to call this one International Holocaust Remembrance Day to make it easier because the real name of it is so long. And they do admit, though, that it coincides with the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau. And the idea that the Knesset delegation is going there this year, they say, is a historic event. Historic. Very important. And then they say for members of the Israeli legislature and Holocaust survivors to stand on the killing floor of the Nazis' factory of genocide is a powerful message of perseverance of the Jewish people and a necessary reminder of the evils that racial hatred can produce. And so I thought it sounded like they're going to stand on the killing floor, and that has to be in the Crematorium 1, the one in Auschwitz 1 that they have renovated there, and people can go to, and I put a picture of that there. That has to be where they're going to stand, so I'm thinking that I wonder if they're going to take any pictures of these Knesset members standing there, because there's no other floor you can stand on if they're talking about a real floor. And they like to call those places factories, you know, factories of death and so on. And then they say and they connect that with the perseverance of the Jews, you know, the Jewish people, that in spite of that, all that attempt to genocide them, they are still around. Okay, and they commend their Polish counterpart, B'nai B'rith Poland, for its efforts. So B'nai B'rith Poland has been working to make this thing on Monday a success at the memorial there. I saw this one little thing from New York City again, naturally, and Representative Carolyn Maloney and other officials attended a ceremony commemorating the 69th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz at the Museum of Jewish Heritage downtown. This was on Friday, yesterday, and it was at 11 a.m. So I have seen this Carolyn Maloney's name before. I don't know if she is. She represents a very Jewish district, or if she is by any chance Jewish. But anyway, they noted that she went to this particular ceremony. Otherwise, there's very little. But here is something from the United Nations that I think is very interesting. When you think that our United Nations, the world's United Nations, which is supposed to represent everybody and be, I guess, working for peace or something, it is the one that created this commemoration. As I've said before, it passed by a voice vote in 2005, and the first one was in 2006, and this is the ninth commemoration this year. And at the front page of the January27.org, at the bottom, is an article written by Robert Forisone explaining and describing how this resolution to have this commemoration annually was passed. It's pretty interesting, because it was the Israelis were the chairman of the General Assembly, or however that works at the time. You know, it's a rotating thing. And they were in charge, and they got it passed. And they got it passed through kind of a tricky way, on a voice vote. There was no actual vote. It just kind of went through by presenting it in a way that nobody could object to. And now here it is, you see. And so it's really an Israeli and a Jewish agenda from the beginning. And they're the ones who keep it going. They keep talking about it. Their newspapers, all the stories basically come from them. Although there's something, that's different. It's in their interest. And it's not surprising that the main speaker at the ceremony at the United Nations on Monday is going to be Steven Spielberg. they usually either have Elie Wiesel or Steven Spielberg. these are the best. They like to have a big star like that. They say the United Nations in their press release about this says the Holocaust took the lives of 6 million Jews. There it is. You know, that number is clearly disputed and uncertain, and yet even the United Nations just puts it out there. Probably some Jewish staff members wrote this whole thing. It sure sounds like it. They probably do all the PR work and advertising and type things for the public information for the UN. In any case, that's what they say. They say it as an absolute fact. 6 million Jews and countless other victims who suffered at the hands of the Nazis and their collaborators 7 decades ago. Understanding its causes, the impact it had on the victims and their families, and finding a means of preventing other such atrocities today is the main reason why the United Nations and countries around the world will hold memorial ceremonies on 27 January. They're trying to find a means of preventing such atrocities today. Is that right? You know, I mean, the reasons that they give for having this, the real reason they have it is because the Jews want it. Jews all around the world, international Jewry, Israel, they want this thing. And as they sell, they go, goes on to say, in New York, Oscar-winning film director, writer, and producer Steven Spielberg will deliver the keynote address, under the theme. The theme is Journeys Through the Holocaust. Well, I've seen so many themes like that for these various things. Journeys. They like that thing, journeys. Now, because they feature the various individuals who were victims, you know, the Holocaust survivor victims and what they went through and what their journey was and so on. And it says that the speech is going to be from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. in the General Assembly Hall of the United Nations. And you have to register and get a ticket to go, naturally. They probably have tons of security. You can't just walk in there and listen to it. And if you want to know more about, now they talk about how Steven Spielberg, following the release of his film Schindler's List in 1993, he solidified his commitment to keeping alive the memory and lessons of the Holocaust by founding the University of Southern California Shoah Foundation, also called the Institute for Visual History and Education, and that's where you can go and find all these filmed interviews, 52,000 video testimonies in 32 languages from 56 countries of Holocaust survivors, of people who are in the camp. And, you know, so they mentioned Schindler's List, naturally, and if you want to learn the a better way of looking at Spielberg and the Schindler's List and Shoah business, you go to on the January 27th website and go to the Shoah business page and scroll down, and there's a video there. It's Ernst Zundel's really good video called Schindler's List. And it's not so long, but it's not short either. And he goes into a lot of interesting stuff there about that video, that movie, and how Germans would see it and so on. It's a very good one. So after that plug for the Shoah Foundation at the University of Southern California, they say, they talk about Remembrance Week. And now here I found out, because I wasn't sure when this thing started and ended, that it says Journeys Through the Holocaust will be held from 23rd to 29th January at United Nations headquarters. So this thing has already started on the 23rd, and they have 2 exhibitions, one that marks the 70th anniversary of the deportation of the Jews in Hungary. That's their big thing, to keep Auschwitz as a real extermination camp because they say all those Hungarian Jews were sent there and were murdered. That started on the 23rd of January. And then there's another one called the March of the Living International on 28th January, an exhibition going up tomorrow. No, I mean on Tuesday after the Monday day. And following the memorial ceremony on Monday at the UN, there's a permanent mission. There's going to be a panel discussion by including the permanent mission of Albania to the United Nations and B'nai B'rith International. Between the two of them, they're going to hold a panel discussion on the rescue of Jews in Albania. You see? You know, this tells me that Jews do rule the world, and they rule the world now. Because wherever you look, the rescue of Jews is the activity that everyone has to be involved in or care about intensely. And whatever they bring on, naturally, I realize this is a Holocaust day, so they're going to be talking about Jews. But, you know, this idea always that that the good people were involved in rescuing Jews. And that's going to be, I think, more, unless we get our world back from this Jewish control, that's going to be more and more and more of the of officialdom, that is going to be more and more about, did you rescue Jews, you know, and how are you treating Jews, and are you protecting Jews, and are you fighting anti-Semitism, which is what now the United Nations says is part of its mission, is to fight anti-Semitism. And we're going to find this, and it's going to be an intolerable world when you have to bow down to Jews in every way, much more than we do now. Well, you know, here in the United States, we don't appreciate, maybe, and we don't have to live under the conditions that that Europe and so many other places that were formerly white strongholds and white nations throughout long, long history have to do already, you know. So then another thing at this UN, they're going to show the film Blinky and Me, which was on the life of animator and Holocaust survivor Yoram Gross. That's going to be screened on the 28th. That will be on Tuesday. So this thing keeps going on. You know, they just keep going as long as they can and get as much out of it as they can. And this is just one thing every year. There's another one coming up in the spring. Now, here's a story that really got me mad. It got me so mad. It was in the Washington Post, and it's titled something like "Swastika on Austrian Tombstone Defies Official Ban." Well, here's we're in Graz, Austria, G-R-A-Z. Graz is the second largest city in Austria after Vienna, and it's not as Jew. It's not as Jew dominated as Vienna is, and always has been, except when Austria was annexed to the Third Reich. But before that and since then, it's a very Jew dominated city or Jew stronghold. But here in Graz, there was a tombstone. A beautiful tombstone in a cemetery. It happens to be a Catholic church cemetery. And they have a picture of it there. It's very nice looking. It's very touching to me. And it's carved into it. Here's what it says on it. Doctor Med, that means he was a medical doctor, who was also, Hans Tita Probst. Then on the next line, S.A. Sturmbannfuhrer. So he was in the S.A., folks. And he was a leader in that. And he was born in, '87. I've got nine here again. I thought I changed that. He was born in 1987, and he died in 1897, and he died in 1934. So he was only 37 years old. Don't know what he died from. Maybe he was murdered by the communists or something. But it says on there in German, but it says it's translated into English. He died in the struggle. He died in the struggle for a great Germany. And then underneath that, there's a small swastika. It's not tiny, but it's not very big. It looks very nice, very, very well designed, the whole stone. It's just a regular kind of a stone. Not a great big monster thing. But now these Jews, and they are Jews. Only Jews would care about this, and they are Jews too. They found this. You know, they're looking for this stuff all the time because they have a law in Austria that, you know, it's against the law to display the swastika or anything like that. And he's also even talking about he fought for Great Germany, which is not approved of either. But also he died in 1934. And this law against, this law, whatever it is, was passed later. But there was a law that was passed in 1939 about something that this could fall under. But he was even before that law. So therefore, whoever owns that, there is somebody who is in charge of that grave, probably some family member, who can't be forced to do anything about it. But here these Jews are just going all out. And this stupid Washington Post actually writes this up and puts it in their newspaper like it's important to, again, you know, for the Jews. And they say that there's another gravestone in that same cemetery that has SS lightning bolts. And they showed a picture of that. I'll link to this site in the program post, but it's just these little, the two very small things. And they found that too. And they're all upset about that and want to, the cemetery people to do something about them, to make these people who own these graves to erase these symbols. And, what they have is in Austria, they have a ban, the law bans symbols. And those displaying them face a criminal charge and a potential prison term. So that's what they'd like to do to these people who are relatives of these people in these graves. And here's the thing, that there's the Graz city spokesman, whose name is Thomas Rajakovics, and the head of the provost of the church that owns a cemetery, whose name is Leibniz. I know that sounds Jewish to people, but it's actually a German name. His name is Christian Leibniz. They don't want to bother with this. They want to leave everything alone. They're defending it, and they're trying to say things that can kind of, you know, make these people stop. And they say that there's, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Rajakovics, maybe, called the swastika an old symbol in the English world that stands for the sun. It was good of him. So he's saying, you know, well, this is an old symbol that has lots of meanings, and, you know, there's no reason to be upset about it. And then the provost of the church said that, is quoted as saying that a lot of the tombstones in the city still displayed the swastika, And he suggested, according to this newspaper writer, that it had a right to remain in cemeteries as the political and societal symbol of the era, even, quote, if I totally oppose this era. So he has to say that, you know, he's not in favor of it, but he doesn't see that, that there's any reason that it should be disallowed. And then this reporter asked, who must be a Jew, asked the church, or this delegation of Jews, I don't know, asked the church if it was willing to put up a sign next to the grave explaining how the swastika is associated with Nazi horrors. And he said no. And he added, now, wouldn't that be a horrible thing to do to somebody's grave? He said, church provost said that symbols displayed on other tombstones might be just as offensive to some people. And he also said that the church was not, he was pressed for a specific, so he mentioned anti-religious symbols on some graves, and then added that the church was not necessarily happy with some of the emblems displayed on the cemetery's Jewish graves. So, you know, here we have a Christian, a Catholic cemetery, and you have Jewish graves in it. You have Jews buried in there for whatever reason, and they have Jewish stuff on their gravestones. And then they're allowed to be buried there, and then they want to put rules on what the Catholics who deserve to be buried there can do with their gravestones. I mean, this is just, it just gets so sick that the way these Jews get up in arms and try to control every little thing that the way they want it to be. And you just, how can people not find them disgusting when they do this? And another case that was brought up here is that they brought up this, that the slogan, Arbeit macht frei, you know, that work sets you free, that's on the Auschwitz camp gate, universally evokes the Auschwitz Nazi death camp, it says. But they found it, a sign with that on it in Gothic letters, on a house belonging to a local centrist politician. And they give his name here, Sven somebody. And, you know, now they're all upset because he's got this slogan, Arbeit macht frei, in Gothic letters on somewhere on his house. And he had to answer, and he said that he bought the house from his father a few years ago, and he left the sign in his memory because his father obviously wanted it there, put it there. But you see now, you know, they want to get everybody in trouble. They want to control everything over there. And the they mention here the Freedom Party. It says, okay, here it is. Austria enacted a law in 1947 banning Nazi symbols that led to the purging of such emblems from Austrian graveyards. And a Vienna cemetery spokesman said that he believes none of the 500,000 gravestones in the Austrian capital now has any such symbol. And if they found any, they would be removed. But in Graz, they're not so sick as they are in Vienna. And they are trying to just kind of diffuse this whole thing and make it go away. But just goes on. There's a law professor named Martin Polacek, who doesn't look Jewish. They have a picture of him. He doesn't look Jewish, but he seems to be working for them. He says that they might create a civil law separate from the 1947 criminal law. And the civil law, he says bans, he said there might be a civil law. He thinks there's a civil law of like that on the books, and it bans displays of Nazi symbols except in the case of research material. And they could use that to force the owner to cover up the swastika on this gravestone of this good man who died in 1934, or have it removed without criminal prosecution. That is, if they covered it up, or if they removed it, had it, just use a machine to wipe it away, then they wouldn't be criminally prosecuted because it's a civil law. Can you imagine? And then Leibniz, the church man, said that he had recently heard of the law, but he doesn't think it applies. And Ryakovitz, the other good guy, says that he's unaware of that law. And then this Polacek says it's unlikely he's unaware of it. And so it goes. But here we have, in the meantime, the swastika remains, but it's only the Jews, as I've said, that care about this. And there's this local Jew, a Vienna Jew, named Fastenbauer, who said the problem is not with Austria's anti-Nazi laws, but a reluctance to enforce them. He says this is disappointing and frustrating. Well, that things like that, in light of how they destroyed the grave of Hitler's parents, and they destroyed Rudolf Hess's grave and pulled him out of there, cremated his body, and so on, it just gets me, makes me madder than almost anything else that I could come across. But when we get back from the break, ladies and gentlemen, we'll get into the arguments against this.
Erinnert an deine Qual. Keiner kommt mehr hierher, niemand vermisst dich mehr. Oh, es tut weh, wenn ich deinen Stein so sehe. Treuer Soldat, mehr als ein namenloses Grab. Ich höre Stimmen, ich höre Gespräch. Du Kamera, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich schwöre dir, so wahr ich hier stehe, ich trage die Fahne, wohin ich auch gehe. Nie werde ich euch verraten, für kein Geld der Welt. Ich kämpfe für dich. Ungebrochener Held, ich kämpfe für dich, unbekannter Held. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich gedanke zu mir sprich. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nehmt dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Und wer da noch lügt, euer Namen benutzt, eure Heldentaten durch Geldgier beschmutzt, den trifft das Schwert von unsichtbarer Hand. Ein Totenwächter von Wotan gesandt, ein Totenwächter. Doch ich höre eine Stimme, die zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Es ist an der Zeit, übernimmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Ihr habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht. Für euch ein, die Kraft, die wir brauchen, wird uns Wotan verleihen. Ihr gabt so viel für dieses Land. Es war der Glaube, der euch verband. Es war der Glaube, der euch verband. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich sag zu mir sprich. Du Kamerad. Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht,
egal was geschieht,
wir werden bei euch sein. Und kehre ich einst an deinen Stein zurück, berichte ich dir von unserem Glück. Dann ist es geschafft und wir sind wieder frei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, darum ging's mir dabei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, denn jetzt sind wir frei. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht,
egal was geschieht,
wir werden bei euch sein.
Ich höre eine Stimme,
zu mir spricht. Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Und ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Halt. Wir sind Geiste, die Waffen. Ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager on Saturday afternoon, and it is January 25th, 2014. The subject is, now getting right into it, the arguments for people who believe in the Holocaust, and particularly we're dealing with Auschwitz in this case, and what are the best arguments to bring up when they come up with their denial stuff. And I just want to mention that I forgot to say in that last part about the article in the Washington Post that, let me forget everything. Can't remember anything. I don't know if I even wrote it down. Well, it seemed important to me. I got it now. That the owner of this gravesite, of this S.A. man, this was brought to his attention, and he was asked if he would, you know, remove the swastika from the grave. He's obviously a relative of this deceased person. And he refused. He said no, he would not, period. So good for him. This is obviously some good people. We're going to come up a little bit later to the good Germans. They're better. There's a lot more good Germans than we realize, than it appears to be, because of the way they're forced to remain quiet. But I did look at my email, and I had a nice little email here from Stuart, and I really appreciate that Stuart seems to listen to all my programs live, or at least he listens to the Saturday one. Maybe he's somewhere where it's easy to do that on Saturday. But he writes us about Carolyn Maloney, the congresswoman that I mentioned, who went to the Jewish museum for the little ceremony that they had there yesterday. And he said she's a Congress critter from the Upper East Side of New York, an example that you don't have to have much intelligence to be elected to Congress, just a groveling suck-up. Well, I have heard of her before, so I guess that was in the connection that I'd heard about her. And so now, thanks for that, Stuart. So now I'm going to go to, I have my page shrunk. My page is shrunk, so this January27.org does not shrink very well. I can't get the whole thing on here. Well, now I've got more of it. Let's see. I'm going to go to the gas chambers page. All right. I'm on the page of January27.org, the gas chambers. But, yeah, Oryx is doing it now. It didn't do it last time I was on the air trying to look at it, but it's doing it now. So I'm going to start with arguments for the gas chamber. Because that's, of course, the main thing that is what this, what the whole thing is all about. And I hope that the first hour brought to your attention why it's so important. You know, once again, all this stuff that brings it up, all this stuff that's done all the time, always because, oh, the Nazis were so terrible. And why were they so terrible? Because they murdered all these Jews, and they're mass murderers. And if you, you know, let anything close to being like them around, you know, get any headway, well, it's going to happen again. And this is what happened. Well, it didn't happen. It did not happen. But on the gas chambers, the first thing I think that could be brought up, particularly like in relation to Monday, because that's the only, the Crema 1 in the Auschwitz 1 camp, the one with all the brick buildings, the only one that's still there, the one that everybody visits, is a reconstruction. And as many times as well as that is known, people still want to forget it and think about it as well. There's the gas chamber. When you go, they think when they go in there, they're looking at, oh, this is where people, this is where it happened, where all these people were in here, and this is what happened to them. This is what it looked like, and so on. But it's like a stage set made to fool people. And it was built by the Soviets it was finished, I guess, in 1947. Even the cremation ovens that are so impressive in there, there's four of them, were built by the Soviets, as far as I understand. That's what I keep reading that, so I guess it's so, because they had also been removed by the Germans. I don't know even how many they had in there, if they only had two, but now there's four of them in there. But if they had four, they were removed because that building was a crematoria, and it was across the street from the hospital, and it was just for cremating, and there was a morgue there. What we see, what's shown as the gas chamber today was the morgue, and although it was shaped, there were some other rooms a part of that too, and that's why they didn't have these heavy-duty doors, and that's why it looked the way it did, and why it was partially underground or mostly underground, or to keep it cooler. And then in the other side was where these cremation ovens were, and you had to have cremation ovens. I'm saying things that are so basic here. I'm going to get on to some more interesting things, but still, you had to have them because the ground around Auschwitz, that whole area was swampy, and you couldn't, if you buried people, it could, in any large number, it could get into the water table, into the water. And, you know, even when there wasn't typhus, but when there was typhus or diseases, that was no good. And if you had to have, you know, coffins for each one, they would just be wooden things that would rot away. So you couldn't afford expensive, you know, bronze coffins for all these people in a concentration camp or a labor camp. So, I mean, it's just kind of ridiculous to question that they had crematories. They did it for health reasons and for environmental and ecological reasons. So that was there, but they stopped using that the one in Birkenau, the first one, Crema 2, was not ready until 1943. So it was at the end of 1943 that they never used that again. And then they remodeled it, and the Germans did, and turned it into a an air raid shelter, and a lot of things were changed. And then the Soviets came, and they turned it into a back into what they wanted it to look like, a gas chamber, which it never had been actually. And they put those ovens in. They're newly built. It's said that they are never used. Those are not unused brick cremation ovens. And the chimney was built new, and the ovens and the chimney are not hooked up together, although they're there. And all of these things. And they, another thing is that they lied to everybody, the world and all the visitors, telling them that this was the real, actual, original gas chamber used by the Germans. And they gassed such and such amount of people there. Until 1990, when everything started kind of breaking apart. But the David Cole video, which is on this website too, on the page, there's only three videos, select videos, because you know, the idea is not to overwhelm people with lots of stuff, like so many, like you can find on, you know, everywhere, but just to give the most important, some of the most important things. There's some other important things should be added, but some of the most important things that if you just know this or see this, it will be enough really for you to understand why this, why what is said about Auschwitz is fraudulent, and why it's called a myth or a hoax or, and it certainly, when David Cole went to Auschwitz in 1992, and secretly filmed his tour and his conversations with the tour guide. I don't know if he, now I don't remember if he secretly or if he let them know and they didn't, they said okay or whatever. And with Francis Pieper or Piper, the lead head historian at that time, who was willing to talk to him because he was Jewish and he had his Jewish little cap on, and so they thought that it was okay to visit with him, and he got the admission from Pieper or Piper that the building that they called the gas chamber was not original, and also that where they got that number. He said, well, they got it from this, that, and the other thing, and you know, his demeanor was so confused and unprepared and dishonest that it was clear. It's clear to everybody who looks at that, that the whole thing is basically a fraud. And it started, a lot of this awareness started from then. So it's the fake gas chamber in Auschwitz I, which can be discussed and proven to anybody you're talking to. And then that is the fact that there's no holes in the roof of Crema II at Birkenau. They want to keep disputing that and keep that like it's not proven or whatever, but it has been, because even though the roof at that Crema II in Birkenau is collapsed, it has been determined, it has been checked over, it has been photographed back at the time when you were allowed to do that, that none of the funny kind of little breaks and holes that they're pointed to on that roof, what's left of, you know, it's collapsed and everything, cracked up and so on. None of those little funny holes that they point to were man-made holes that were made in the beginning of the, you know, before the building was demolished, of the type that would be professionally made for this purpose of pouring Zyklon B pellets down through these holes in this flat roof, which was once again over a morgue type part of the building that they claim to be a gas chamber. And there's been expert testimony about that. So you'd have to tell the person that you need to see proof, that they need to show proof, the person you're discussing this with, they need to show proof that that roof had holes in it for this purpose before it was demolished. Because after it was demolished, some people went and tried to break holes into it to make it look like they were original, but they were kind of distorted from the demolition of the building. But it doesn't fly. Experts on things like this can show that it doesn't. And the first article here under gas chambers is Robert Foreson, just an excerpt where he talks about this no holes. And there's a lot more to be read, and there's four articles that are recommended that are linked to at the end of that you can go to that go into more detail. I didn't want this site to be bogged down with a lot of detail, particularly when you read it somewhere else. So these are can all be found on Kodo.com, but they're all a part of the same subject. They all go together, and it would be good to read those for further information about the no holes. But that's a big part of proving that Crema 2 was not was never a gas chamber the way that they describe it, all the witnesses describe it as being. And then there's the no blue pigment argument, which is also quite conclusive. And Germar Rudolph talks about that in the next article on that page, which is a new article that he wrote for the site. And he combines it with talking about what they've done to his Wikipedia page and the trouble he's had and why it's not reliable now at all, except only for his biographical information. He managed to get that straight, but the rest of it, they just will not. And he goes through, it's interesting, how he continues to try to correct things, and somebody there continues to undo what he does. So, he became one of those members of that, where you can edit, one of those editors for a while, in order to edit his own page, and he didn't have any success. So there again, the point is that what you read, if people say, well, I read about all this. Well, even on Wikipedia, supposedly an encyclopedia that people can go and correct, and is supposed to go through it, have a process where you can, get things right. Well, there's Jews there in charge who are able to overcome anything they don't want to have on there. And there, here's the picture of the well-known picture of Germar standing with the blue pigment on the wall of a disinfestation chamber, a small building or small room where they disinfected clothing. And there are others examples too that where that blue pigment is. It's quite amazing, and it's very permanent. It doesn't ever disappear. Once it's there, it's just can last for 1,000 years. It's just not something that would fade away. And but it is not on in any of the rooms that they claim to be gas chambers. And pictures here just of the one in Crema 1, in Auschwitz 1, because that's the only one that's there. There isn't any others. But they did go down in Crema 2. Which is the only one in Birkenau that you could actually go underground in and still see what that area looked like. And the walls are there and so on. And as we know, Fred Leuchter was the first, and then Germar Rudolph went and did it himself. And they came with the same conclusion that there was none of this blue pigment from Zyklon B being used there. And to any reasonable people, that is proof. That's proof that Zyklon B was never used in that building, in that area that is said to have been a gas chamber. If it had been in the way that they said, you know, they say that 500,000 mostly Jews were killed in that gas, so-called gas chamber in Crema II. That is just incredible. Of course, that's another exaggeration. Well, there wasn't anybody killed in there because none of that ever happened, but that's an exaggerated figure right there. Well, we'll get into some of those figures maybe later, if there's time, but, you know, for reasonable people, but we're not dealing with reasonable people, but the believers are so, they believe in these so-called Holocaust historians and so on, and they find it difficult to think that all these people who talk about the Holocaust would all be lying. You know, it's the same with all of these false flag things. It's the same. Yet, you know, people think, well, all these people, they must be telling the truth. Well, a lot of them they're not historians. You know, most of the so-called Holocaust historians are not historians. They don't go by historian standards. There's only a few that are real historians, like that Goldhagen and Ken Walzer, but they are Jewish who are totally committed to the Holocaust mythology, the Holocaust reality, and so they're only working there to come up with arguments that will reinforce it. They're not looking for the truth about it. But the rest of them who are not historians are also, they're just committed to, promoting the Holocaust belief. And because they're loyal to their tribe, loyal to it. It would be best to kind of stay away from that kind of talk, but it's hard to avoid it. When it, you know, because it's going to come up. This is one thing that people always say. You know, I was going to do, I had talked originally about adding to this site one of these most frequently asked questions. And as I was looking at this stuff today, I remembered that. I thought, oh, I never did that. I forgot about that. So that's something I'm going to try to do and maybe get some other people to contribute to it, because it would be a good thing to have here. So this thing about the pigment is very important. So that's three things that are actual fact that they can't be denied. And then there is, say going on down on this page, there's the, article by Carlos Porter, which he's always, humorous in the way it's not that everything he says is not the truth. It is. But then it ends with this picture he has of a real gas chamber. And we've seen once in a while, we see these pictures of real gas chambers and compares it with this room in Auschwitz that's called a gas chamber. The other thing is that these leaky old rooms cannot have been used to kill thousands and thousands of people with gassing. And there's so many other things that can be said about this, like rounding them up. I mean, getting them to go in there, even. Getting all these Jews over and over again. They say that they all knew what was going to happen to them. They all heard the rumors. There was all these rumors. And when they went to take a shower, they thought they were going to be gassed, but then they were just taking a shower. Some of them would say that. But if they had suspicion of that, how would you get them all to go into these rooms and then, over and over again? Well, that's in that video, also on the video page, The Hidden Truth. Is it The Hidden Truth About Auschwitz? That's the first video on that page. And that is excellent. And that comes out, that is discussed there, that these, you couldn't get all these people to actually go without rioting. You know, if they're going to their death, then what have they got to lose? They might as well start trying to kill the guards. And there was never that many of them. And there were these workers, the Jewish workers, who were actually leading them in there. So that's another story. But I'm going to go on to the fake shower rooms when they talk about, well, there are all these testimonies that that's on that page, too. There's something on that page that you're on now, the gas chamber page, about the fake shower heads. That's brought up all the time, even though it has been proven and shown and accepted by most Holocaust so-called historians, Holocaust writers and so on, and museums and so on, that this didn't happen, that people weren't gassed from showers, from shower heads. And yet, it keeps being said, even by guides, and probably not only guides at the former concentration camps, but probably guides in these museums, Yad Vashem and United States Holocaust Museum and so on, because it's written about in blogs and all over the internet. It's repeated by these survivors who say that they were so fortunate that the gas didn't come out of the shower heads when they went to take a shower and stuff. But it remains a belief, even though it's been disproven officially, that there were such a thing as fake shower rooms. And in fact, at Auschwitz, Crema 4 and 5 had shower rooms. They didn't have the same kind of gas chamber as is said in the Crema 2 and 3. They had places for showering, and they used to say that the victims were led into these shower rooms to take a shower and given a towel and everything, and then they were gassed because the gas came out of the shower heads. And that's impossible, and it never happened. And just think about all these eyewitnesses who say that they gave everybody a towel and a piece of soap, and then they went in and they were gassed. And then when they went and carried them out, they never talk about all those towels they had to take out of there, along with the people, or those little pieces of soap or anything. I don't know. You know, that's all forgotten about at that point of the story. So then there's the problem of credibility in this context, because of all these stories that have been told that you could bring up with somebody. How can the Holocaust historians and museums remain credible when they went along with all these lies for so long? And they still will do it if they get away with it, or they still won't stop their employees from saying these things. The fact is that the people who are upholding the Holocaust myth are mostly doing so for political reasons and other reasons, not because it has any validity, the myth itself, but because politically they need to keep it in place. And for the Jews, it's political too, but you know, they want to keep it in place now because it gives them so many benefits. And if it would come apart, they would look very bad, to say the least. So those are the reasons. Those are part of the reasons that people continue to support it. And all these Jewish people continue to support it. And the Jewish leadership does. And all the current political leaders do, even those, you know, the non-Jewish ones, for political reasons. So another very important page, I think, I mean, that as far as the kind of arguments that believers will come up with, is the eyewitnesses. And that is you know, they always will say, well, what all these people said and testified, and they, you know, what, how could they all be saying that and it not be true? They wouldn't all be saying that. Well, at Nuremberg, one thing that can be said is that when all, because at Nuremberg was where so much of this was established to begin with, eyewitnesses were not allowed to be cross-examined. Mostly they didn't even get on the stand. Some of them did, but mostly they just signed depositions, and those depositions were allowed to be put into the record as if they were, had actually been there and said it in person in the courtroom. And but there was no cross-examination. So and when there were trials later, and they can be brought up, like the Zundel trial in Canada, and well, I don't have the Irving trial is another one that took place in Great Britain. They had cross-examination there. When they had trials like that, the testimony of the eyewitnesses or the people saying testifying for the Holocaust belief was always demolished, or in, and it just fell apart. They couldn't stand up to the cross-examination because their story was wasn't true and didn't have any real basis to it. So I would say, and I think you could say, you could ask them, you could say there's not one reliable eyewitness to crimes and gassings. Not one. There's not one reliable eyewitness. You could say, like Faurisson says about, says, show me or draw me a gas chamber. He always likes to say, show me, show me. And nobody ever come, no, none of these people that are hundreds of these people writing about the Holocaust and defending it, none of them has ever responded. They can't do that. They don't show or draw one. They have these, of course, they do have the blueprints for the crematorium that are available, that are there. But they don't really show that. Again, it's another area where they don't really show. You have to do quite a bit of research for that, and have the pictures there and know how to talk about them. So that's not one of my items here. But you know, if you if nobody, if you say tell me one absolutely reliable witness, give me the name and describe who was one absolutely reliable witness, and see what if they can come up with one. Every time at Elie Wiesel Cons the World website, when some of these people write a comment and they say, oh, you don't know what you're talking about, or blah, blah, blah. And then I ask them to answer a few questions. They never reply. Never. They never reply. They can't answer the simplest question that would defend what they're saying. Then they will say, well, there are former SS officers or concentration camp guards who testified that these things happened. Well, the fact is that every one of these got immunity or early release, and they were also reprieved from experiencing torture. Some of these so-called guards, like from camps not at Auschwitz, were not German. They were capos, or, you know, they were employed and so on. They're other nationalities. So they didn't have any trouble saying what they were told to say afterwards, when, particularly when their own country was now allied with somebody else, with the other side and so on. So some of them are those. But some of these SS people, except for just a very few that you might call bad apples, they were under indictment And it was clear, made clear to them that they would get a better deal if they cooperated. And they did, because they had nothing. They had, you know, long, long prison sentence or death facing them. So they thought, how am I going to prove anything if I try to stand up for the truth when they're not going to believe me anyway? And it's true. They wouldn't have accomplished anything, but they certainly helped the other side by cooperating. But that's the reason they did it. So the eyewitness testimony is some of the most unimpressive that you're ever going to find. And if you read this about Mel Mermelstein, I mean, that is a riot. You know, that's a typical. He's typical of the kind of witnesses to this Auschwitz myth that exists. And then there's a nice article by Jürgen Graf, but also a long excerpt from Carlo Mantegna's book, 60 Years of Propaganda. And by the way, that book, which was never translated out of Italian, has been translated for this site and does exist here, and it's on the sidebar there. So you can read the whole book, and I know there are people who are interested in it, and it's the only English translation available anywhere at the present moment, as far as I know. It will probably be added here and there from here on in sometime, but not at the moment. You'll only find it here. And there's so much good stuff there. This one is all about these eyewitnesses and the crazy stories that they told, which nobody believes anymore. So most of everything that all eyewitnesses said, except for a few of them that are still the basis of this Auschwitz lie, they're no longer believed. And yet at one time, they made up the whole story. So going on from there, the 6 million, there's no page on this site for the 6 million because it's been covered so much. But there's just so many, many examples of 6 million being used whenever Jews talk about Jewish suffering. The earliest one I think that I've seen was 1897, although there may be some earlier. But right here, I got several examples just in the last few things I've posted at my website, and right here, there's 600,000, but also, there were some other things that were sick. Oh yeah, the International Jew Program on this past Thursday, I used this little newspaper excerpt from 1914 about Louis Marshall, because the show was about Louis Marshall. And it said there, in 1914, that 6 million Jews were needed help in Europe, in the war zone, in the World War I war zone. They needed help. 6 million. It's always 6 million. I mean, when you see 6 million over and over and over again for every kind of thing, then it can't mean anything when they use it for the Holocaust. But these people are compulsive in having to use that number. It's just they must be incredibly superstitious in that number is what has to be used for them for their whole schemes not to fall apart or something, for their schemes to be to work, some kind of magical thing, because it's so suspect. And yet, in spite of the fact that this has been the 6 million, this overuse of the 6 million number has been publicized so much, these big, like the United Nations and all these newspapers and so on, they continue to say 6 million without blinking an eye. They have no shame. Another page I think is very good that can be talked about is the moral question, the last one, because the morality comes up a lot. And the whole idea that, well, the Nazis were pure evil and that that Nazi Hitler's regime there was pure evil, and you can't contradict that. You know that's true, and so on. And you can say with a lot of backup, be able to back it up, that the Allies were more immoral than the Germans, that 17 million ethnic Germans were killed, many after the war, by so-called victims, who for some reason are excused from what they did because it's claimed that, oh, they were such victims of these people, they had to get their revenge. You can't blame them. Things like that. But the false figure of 11 million victims of the Nazis, that is what is usually given, 6 million Jews and 5 million others that they can throw in there, they have to keep that figure up because of those 7 million dead Germans. Now, that doesn't even bring up all those Russians that were killed, but that's in a different time period, so I'm not going to bring that up. Now, the first article on there is by Bardesh. What is his first name? Maurice Bardesh. You know, you could go and read that whole book of his. It's not a real long book. I want to do that one of these days. I really like his writing. I'm going to read this one little section from him that I like very much, which I think would be effective to bring up with people. He says, and this was in 1948, he was a Frenchman in France and watching all this going on. And he says he was criticizing the trials at Nuremberg and the death sentences for all these National Socialists and what was going on in Germany. And he says, will we, meaning the French nation, will we allow thousands of men at this very time to suffer and to be outraged at our refusal to testify, at our cowardice, at our false commiseration? They push away this straitjacket in which we wish to put their voice and their past. They know that our newspapers lie, that our films lie, that our writers lie. They know it and will not forget it. Will we endure these looks of disdain which they rightly shoot at us? The whole history of this war is to be redone. We know it. Will we refuse to open our door to the truth? Well, that's just kind of nice, you know, nicely put, but the fact is that it's been considered a good argument to point out that we know that our newspapers lie. We know that our films lie. We know that most of the writers that are given a, you know, a good position to for their writing and a good income and so on, that they lie in order to get that. That's something that can always be brought up too when they start talking about, well, but everybody agrees that this happened and so on. And then Bradley Smith had a really good idea here when he writes in his having that dream that he was gassed at Auschwitz and his thoughts that followed upon that these Jews would not ever do this. The Jews who were called the Sonderkommando, who were working in the gas chambers, and they did all that work. You know, supposedly, the people testifying, the eyewitnesses and so on, were always saying, and even these guys themselves, these commandos themselves said that they only had 4 months. That after 4 months of working in the gas chambers, then you yourself were murdered, and they brought in new people because they didn't want any witnesses to what was going on. And yet, most of these people are telling this right now. So they weren't murdered. They put out these stories, I think, in order to make it appear that these people were victims of the Germans too, that they weren't on the German side, and somehow they were forced to do what they did. But of course they couldn't be forced. All they could do is be killed, or maybe they could come up with some kind of a torture or something. But they never speak of that. None of them say, I did it because I was tortured, or I was told I would be tortured if I didn't. Or they don't say, I did it because they told me they were going to kill my family if I didn't. Well, if all the Jews were already being sent to these camps, what was that going to, you know, what meaning did that have? So they have nothing to say. So they just don't say anything. They just put out these stories, which fall apart if you cross-examine the story even. You know, if you look critically at it, you see that, well, wait a minute, there's too many questions here with no answers. And so this just doesn't hold. And this is the backbone of the gas chamber, the gassing, is that there were these Jews that Bradley calls work Jews who were in charge of it all, really, and they carried it out. In spite of the fact that these were their own people. So that's a really odd part of the whole thing that should be looked at. And then the page, What Was Auschwitz, has some good information on it. And I particularly like because I was completely unfamiliar with it. I had never seen it. I didn't know it was available. Was this pamphlet written by Thies Christofferson in like 1973. And there's quite a lot of it there, but it's not all of it there, but there's a link to where you can read all of it, but the most important parts are there. And what I liked, I think is the best for talking to people about this, is that where he said, yet the German people continued to believe in these mass murders. Why? So he's asking the question, why did the Germans believe in these mass murders? And he says, we who know the truth, have we not burdened ourselves with an awful responsibility? Why did we keep silent for so long? I shall try to answer these questions. His first answer is, we have not kept silent at all. There was no one who wanted to hear our reports. No paper wanted to publish them. No publisher print them. And that was the fact that at the end of the war, the German people did not really believe what the Allies were telling them had happened. Everybody was in a kind of shock. Everything was in chaos. They were not being treated well. There wasn't enough to eat. There were all kinds of problems, not enough places to live. You know, just all kinds of problems these people had. And yet they still were not buying all of this. They knew about war propaganda. They still liked their old government, the majority of them, but they realized that, there was no hope for that. I mean, that was gone, and here they were in this situation. But they, I would say that, I'll go on. He says his number two thing, even today there are still enough witnesses alive who could verify my statements. Now, this was in 1973, and make similar ones of their own. What we need, however, is an unbiased constitutional state. To tell the truth is tantamount to social ostracism and financial suicide. Well, this actually is the same argument is so useful today, that of all the laws against revisionism, and how you can't say anything that is that if it's not critical of very critical of National Socialism and Hitler, and you can't deny anything about Holocaustianity. So, but this was the same thing going on then. And you know, they passed laws right away in Germany. That was part of the whole I'm not going to go into that, but this was done already at Nuremberg. And the allied militaries were in control, and they took over the schools. They destroyed all the textbooks right away. And the kids had no, the kids, when they went back to school, which happened pretty quickly, they had no textbooks for quite a long time until they got, the Allies got new ones published with the information the way they wanted it. And they had to take all the, they had to do everything by taking notes. And some of them said they got so tired of writing, they had to write all day long because they had to take, they didn't have any books. They had to take everything down from the teacher telling them and, you know, write it down on their, in their notebooks. So they were, they realized that it was all about indoctrinating the youth. And once they got these youth they had now indoctrinated, then they would have a generation of people who would believe what they wanted them to believe. And even then they didn't all, but, even today they don't all. There's more people who like the past before 1945, is acknowledged. But they can't really talk about it. So, but you know, the indoctrinating process is what they said was so bad about National Socialism. But every nation indoctrinates its children. And there's a certain amount of indoctrination that needs to take place, if you're going to have a unified people. Well, now their indoctrination was to unify the Germans against being German. But here he says, another one, no, later on down, number six, to disprove the mass murders in concentration camps would not only prove the entire thrust of post-war German politics to be a mistake, but the post-war politicians still in power would have to admit their political concepts to be entirely wrong. This must not be allowed. And so, again, the political underpinning of this myth is stronger than any other. It's not about morality. It's not about genocide and preventing genocide, future genocides, and so on. It's all about keeping the political power, keeping their political philosophy in control, and not allowing anything else to come in to displace it. So it's all political. And then he says, number seven, of course, there are also cowards, liars, and paid witnesses. Some of the accused, who must have known that the testimony against them was false, still made a confession because they thought, and of this they were no doubt assured, that they would gain advantages for themselves if they adjusted their statements to the testimony of the accusers. However, he says it must also be stated that confessions were obtained through torture, too. So some of them were tortured to do so. Others, as came out before, earlier, may, you know, went along with it and signed the confessions because they were told that they would, you know, get such and such advantages, they would be released or whatever. And if they didn't do it, they would never be released. They would be found guilty of many, and go for many, many years. They would be sent to Soviet Union, maybe to Siberia, whatever. So what, you know, what decision would you make when you realize that even if you stood up against this, you are not going to change the outcome at all? So this is how the Holocaust process, the Holocaust believers, though, have this, that they say that, well, a lot of these German SS and, you know, people on that side, they also confessed to these German crimes. And they wouldn't have done so if, you know, except that their conscience bothered them. But see, that's just not true. And you have to tell this whole story about and give examples, and probably even maybe examples from more recent times, about why people do this. Look at the show trials in the Soviet Union. All kinds of people just admitted to things that they never did, because that was going to be worse for them if they didn't. And they were not going to be given a chance to say, what they thought was true. That was never going to come out. If they wouldn't say what they were told to say, they would suffer. But the truth would not come out. So of course they wouldn't have them as a witness, but they could see that other people were going to agree to do it, you know, so they might as well agree too. Why be the lone, sacrificial lamb? That's just basic psychology. So that's, all right. That's, we've got a few minutes left. What else would I say about this and about, let me check my email, see if anybody's sent anything by any chance. Oh, where is this? Here we go. Here's something from Hadding. Maybe this is this. Oh, he's checking on Oscar Groening. Well, okay, I'll read you this because I should have done that myself. He says that Wikipedia says about this Oscar Groening, you know, who I mentioned earlier that was used by this letter writer to me. When he was captured on the Western Front by the British in 1945, he indicated that the previous assignment had not been at Auschwitz, but in an administrative office. You know, I did read about him, but I had forgotten about him. I didn't write it down or save it or something. And it goes on to say it was not until more than 40 years later, that's right, that this Groening became known for claiming that he had been at Auschwitz. The fact that he waited so long to claim that he was at Auschwitz and the fact that it contradicts what he said earlier reduces his credibility. So here's a great case where these people are used by, say, this letter writer to me, by the Holocaust people. Say, well, what about this, you know, Oscar Groening? He said this, and he was, you know, he was a SS or something in Auschwitz. Well, you see, the whole thing is just a big lie. They lie, and you have to know the facts, and then you have to remember them. I think that's the hard part. And you have, I think we should be making lists and for ourselves, and eventually we'd remember everything if we wrote it and talked about it enough to respond to these things. And he said that Groening's responsibilities included counting and sorting the money stolen from exterminated prisoners. That's he read that also in Der Spiegel. So we're supposed to believe that internees were allowed to keep their money inside the camp. So is this Oscar Groening, that we're supposed to believe that prisoners could keep their money inside the camp until they were gassed, and then their money was counted by Oscar Groening? This doesn't seem logical. Well, it must be that sometimes they say they hid the money, and then they say, oh, that's why they searched the anal canals of the dead, of the gassed Jews, because they'd find stuff hidden in there, you know, valuables, and they'd pull that stuff out of there. I don't, you know, it's all so crazy. That was from Hadding. Thank you, Hadding. And ladies and gentlemen, I probably didn't do as good a job of this making these number one responses as I could have, but I will try. I will maybe improve on this, and we'll keep doing some of this stuff. Anyway, I thank you for listening today. I hope you got something out of it. And I do hope that you will be directing people to this website, particularly around tomorrow and Monday, and they'll learn something from it. Thanks again, and see you next Saturday.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.